the F word, foreclosures.
Buying foreclosed homes can be a great investment. I'm here to explain to you how you can buy foreclosed homes. First thing you're going to want to do is get a list of these properties available in the area.
It's a bonanza for real estate poachers when there's a long list of foreclosed properties on the block. It's a tragedy for families when they lose their homes. Foreclosures bite deep. We're never letting go. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, June 16th, a second wave of foreclosures. We're going to talk about it in just a moment. I'm John Huckenberry, and co-hosting with me is Femi Okeh.
Good morning, everybody. Coming up this hour, we hear reports on opposition demonstrations in the streets of Tehran, the largest demonstrations there since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Also, seven sports are competing to be included in the 2016 Olympics. We hear from the man who's making the case for softball. And we kick off a week-long series on healthcare by checking in with two doctors who are using technology to cut costs. Those stories coming up, but first, headlines.
And in the headlines, Iran's powerful Guardian Council says it's willing to recount all contested ballots from last week's presidential election. Initial results returned President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad to power, but all three opposing candidates have challenged that, citing voter fraud. It's not clear if the opposition candidates will accept a partial recount. Meanwhile, hospital officials say eight people were killed yesterday in mass protests over the results. State radio reports that the shooting started after protesters, quote, tried to attack a military location. It's thought the crowds may have tried to enter a facility for volunteer militia linked to Iran's Revolutionary Guard. Femi?
Here in the United States, President Obama meets with South Korean President Lee Myung-bak at the White House. They will discuss North Korea's recent nuclear and missile tests. The South Korean leader has taken a hard line with the North since he took office early last year, and the North in turn routinely calls him a traitor. The meeting comes after the youngest son of Kim Jong-il reportedly visited China last week for secret meetings with the Chinese leader Hu Jintao. That's according to unconfirmed reports from a Japanese newspaper. 26-year-old Kim Jong-un is next in line to take over the leadership of North Korea. Meanwhile, President Obama is expected to order the U.S. Navy to intercept North Korean ships suspected of holding nuclear technology. That's according to senior administration officials who spoke with our partner, The New York Times. The Navy will request permission to inspect the ships but won't board them by force.
Looking ahead now, a few big economic indicators are due out this hour. We'll learn the number of houses that began construction last month, as well as the producer price index, which measures the average price level for a fixed basket of wholesale goods. That's the wholesale inflation rate. Asian stock markets took a tumble today. Benchmark indices for both Japan and Hong Kong were down about 3%. Europe's doing a bit better. All major indices there flat at the moment. A flat opening is predicted on Wall Street based on the futures trading. On Wall Street yesterday, the Dow tumbled more than 2%. It closed at 86.12, and the S&P dropped 2.4%. It begins trading at 9.24. Healthcare, that's what we're talking about all hour. We've been asking you to design the perfect healthcare plan for yourself. Yesterday, what was included? What would you not include? How would you make it more affordable? That's the question today. Would you eliminate insurance? How would you cut costs for delivering healthcare? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Keep those strong opinions coming.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Huckenberry here with Femi Okeh. We've been talking about this at least since yesterday, but it's not a theme we invented. Listen to Barack Obama speaking before the American Medical Association yesterday.
Make no mistake, the cost of our health care is a threat to our economy. It's an escalating burden on our families and businesses. It's a ticking time bomb for the federal budget, and it is unsustainable for the United States of America.
If the federal budget and the U.S. economy are a ticking time bomb, they have a number of fuses. The tightrope we are walking is no more in evidence than noting this relationship between the health care system and the cost of health care and people's budgets and their own sense of being on the edge. The foreclosure crisis is not going away, and medical bankruptcies are one reason why foreclosures are rising. According to the latest housing data, more homeowners than ever are going into default, and housing analysts are saying that the latest wave is heightened because of rising unemployment, health care costs, tipping people into bankruptcy. These are people who once had good credit and who had prime mortgages, not exotic, strange mortgages. No, this is the center of the middle class that is now being brought into this wave of foreclosures. Here to talk about it and what it means for the economy, especially as we're getting signs that maybe the worst of the recession is over, is Anya Kamenetz, staff writer for Fast Company magazine and author of Generation Debt. She joins us in the studio. Anya, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a disturbing trend as we are seeing certain bottoms in market statistics and maybe the unemployment numbers. We're also seeing a wave of employment-related foreclosures, healthcare-related foreclosures hitting the market. What are the implications? And give us a sense of the raw numbers here.
Sure. Well, I mean, so unemployment is pretty much twice what it was last year. It's 9.4%. We've had double-digit declines in the price of housing as well. And so people, the indication is that the impact on the middle class of these waves of unemployment, the waves of layoffs, it's just beginning to be felt. It really is. We're not at the end of it. We're at the beginning.
So at the end of last year, people like Hank Paulson in the outgoing Bush administration were saying that we're looking for the bottom in the so-called housing correction. You know, it seemed to me he was saying that at some point the subprime mortgages were going to correct and that would be the impact on prices. You're saying, no, there's actually a second wave here.
Well, you know, that might be true from the bank's point of view, but we have to remember that in the middle class in America, household income has been stagnant for almost 20 years. So, you know, the idea that just because, you know, the banks are in a better shape and they know what the value of what their mortgages are, that doesn't mean that for middle class people that they're not in danger of losing more of their net worth than they already have.
Give me a sense of a profile of a family that's solidly in this class of sort of second wave foreclosures.
Well, I guess, you know, the LA Times has been carrying stories, for example, of police officers that are going into foreclosure. You got teachers going into foreclosure, people who maybe their student loans, a lot of the forgiveness programs have been canceled. And so, you know, all of a sudden their bills don't add up anymore.
Are any of the programs that the federal government either on an emergency basis brought into being money for people who are in trouble, moratoriums on foreclosures for individuals who are on the edge, do any of these help the middle class group that you're talking about here?
Well, just to get a sense of the numbers here, you know, the Center for Responsible Lending is forecasting 2.4 million delinquencies in 2009. Obama's mortgage plan so far has helped about 100,000 people.
That's a tiny percentage, really.
It really is a tiny percentage because, you know,
it's less than 5%.
Exactly. There's no impetus on the banks to actually make a deal with these people. I mean, they're encouraged to.
But why not? See, that's what I don't understand. Mm-hmm. If somebody forecloses, they have to report that as a loss.
Right.
If they can keep that person on the books, even paying a reduced payment, don't they get to claim that as an asset? And doesn't that help their balance sheet?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, the math does work out that it is almost in all cases, it's cheaper to restructure the loan. It's better for the homeowner and it's better for the bank. But in order to restructure and write down that loan, they are going to have to take a one-time loss. And the banks have been so protective of their balance sheets because we've been hearing all this about bad banks and banks getting bailouts. And so they have been very leery of actually taking that step. Their inclination is to try to keep the loan on the books as long as possible, ride this out.
So why does it make it difficult? And we've heard stories of people who actually have trouble finding the person at the bank who can actually listen to the reason that you're talking about here. Look, I don't want to default. I've got good credit. We can work this out. It's actually hard to find that person that you can actually negotiate with.
Well, you know, that goes back to the nucleus of this whole problem, right, is that these loans were repackaged and resold. They were, you know, they're serviced by servicers. They're sold as securities. The person that you got your mortgage from is not the same person who owns it now. And so there's really no one to sit down with.
And there's no one to sit down with, and so and your loan could be held by someone in Taiwan at this point, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, the more it's sliced and diced, the less there's that sense of personal responsibility of maybe a community bank where they would say, well, this is about property values in my neighborhood. Because let's not forget, foreclosures don't just affect the homeowner. They affect your neighbors. They affect property values for entire cities.
What can a family do if they realize that they're headed down a road that might lead to foreclosure and take preemptive steps to prevent this sort of thing from happening?
Well, you know, there's really no easy answer, and I think that, you know, we need to recognize that it's a very, very painful decision. It's an emotional decision for a lot of families. But foreclosure itself, you know, you can restructure your credit as soon as 24 months after foreclosure. You can get new credit. You can get a new home as soon as 5 years later. So it doesn't have to be the end of the world. The alternatives to foreclosure, before you actually have to sign that paper, you can possibly get rid of your house in a short sale, and that means that you have a third-party buyer who's willing to take it off your hands for less than what's owed on the mortgage. In some situations, you may be able to sign the deed over to the bank, accept a deed in lieu of foreclosure. And then there is also an outside possibility of assumption, and that is when maybe a friend or relative, you sign the deed over to them, they accept the payments.
Annie, are you seeing a difference in the way that mortgages are now actually given out to first-time homebuyers, second-time homebuyers now?
Well, we're seeing a tightening of credit standards all across the board. I mean, people are having – there are much higher standards for the credit scores that people have to have. They do have to show employment records. They do have to show, you know, that they do have a steady source of income as well. And that is another problem as well because, you know, in order to be even eligible for the types of restructuring and refinancing that is included in Obama's plan, you have to be able to show a steady source of income. If you are unemployed, you may not be eligible for that deal.
So I guess we were talking about the subprime mortgage, and we were talking about that, you know, 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
The price issues, the fact that these foreclosures would have an impact on prices in communities, and all of a sudden you see a crash of home prices, that was affecting places that had a proliferation of subprime mortgages, places like Las Vegas, places like South Florida, places right. like California communities. In this instance, this second wave of foreclosures is distributed geographically in a very different way. Can you explain?
Absolutely. So, right. So the foreclosures that we're seeing now are in markets that did not see that huge price inflation, that price bubble. It's really happening in middle-class communities all across the country.
So Detroit, Ohio, places like that, the middle part of the country, the Midwest is definitely affected by these.
Absolutely.
Let's look at some of the raw statistics. 5.4 million of the country's 45 million home loans are delinquent or in some stage of the foreclosure process in the first 3 months of this year. Now, you go to the financial channels and all of these kind of raving sort of telethon economists slash journalists say, well, that means most of the mortgages are actually not delinquent. Most of the payments are actually not in foreclosure. Look at this tiny minority. How much of an impact does that 5.4 million have on things like price and the ripple effect in the economy that you alluded to a little while ago?
Well, I mean, I think it's going to have a huge ripple effect. I think, you know, every time a house is in foreclosure, it can reduce your neighbor's property values. It can depress the market in that area. And so I think that the impact is going to be very long term. Not to mention, you know, this is an impact on families and communities. These are people that are going to have trouble paying other bills. They're going to have trouble, again, with health expenses. And, you know, it really is something that it's devastating to communities.
It causes credit to tighten, which restricts business activity. It reduces the likelihood that new homes will be built, which reduces business activity. And, of course, let's come back to the last issue of health care. You know, we asked at the top of the program, how would you make health care more affordable? First of all, is health care a big driver of these bankruptcies? And since we're asking everyone the question of making health care affordable, I'm wondering if you have a plan.
Sure. So, well, do I have a plan? I don't know. But, you know, Elizabeth Warren, about 10 years ago in the two-income trap, showed that medical costs even then were the leading cause of bankruptcy. And that has only continued, you know, the shift of cost onto the individual. For me, I would really like to see a plan that encourages spending on preventative medicine because I know for me and my friends, you know, we're in that stage of life where we may not be going to the doctor regularly, but as much as we can be encouraged to, you know, spend on public health, that is, I think, going to reduce costs overall.
And the president was saying yesterday in his speech before the American Medical Association that preventive health actually produces jobs. If you create a preventive health system, it actually adds jobs to the system, doesn't subtract. Anya Kamenetz, staff writer for Fast Company magazine, author of Generation Debt. Thanks for discussing this second wave of foreclosures in the U.S. economy.
Thanks for having me.
can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
The debate is beginning for redesigning healthcare in the United States. So we're asking you, how would you make healthcare more affordable? How would you cut costs? Would you include something in your coverage, or maybe there's something you wouldn't cover?
I think the problem is the abortion problem. So I think if we end abortion, I think we'd go a long way into solving the healthcare problem in the long term.
How you would budget healthcare, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The competition for the 2016 Olympics is already heating up. Seven sports have been selling themselves to the International Olympics Committee, trying to guarantee a chance for their sport to compete in the 2016 Summer Games. So we're looking at golf, karate, squash, baseball, softball, roller sports, and rugby. They're all trying to get those two top sweet spots in the Olympic program. So joining us to talk about pitching into the Summer Games is Don Porter, president of the International Softball Federation. He's in Lausanne, Switzerland. And we also have our friend Dave Zirin. He's a sports writer and author of A People's History of Sports in the United States. Good morning to you both. But let's start with Don out there in Switzerland. You had to pitch the IOC for softball, Don. Give us your pitch.
Well, we did yesterday make our presentation to the IOC Executive Board. 20 minutes to get across to the executive board what we see softball as being a very viable and very vibrant part of the Olympics in 2016, although we had played in four Olympic Games prior to that, 1996 through 2008.
Now, you got kicked out, Don. So what happened?
Well, the vote in 2005 at the IOC meeting in Singapore was a tie vote, so we actually lost by one vote. But, you know, I think mainly we learned a lesson, and the lesson was that what changes did we have to make our sport more attractive and in a lot of ways to the Olympic program, and that's what we've been working on since 2005, and we've made a lot of changes and taken a different direction for our sport. As we move towards the opportunity now to get back on the Olympic program.
So, Don, you're going to use a flaming ball then?
Well, that's a possibility, Dave, but right now I think that's in the background at this point. We're doing a lot of things with our sport, rule changes in the last several years. We're doing a lot of development work in Africa and the Middle East. We're giving opportunities now to a lot of young female athletes, especially in Africa and Muslim countries. And we're building up in those countries where our sport's not very popular or not organized. And so that's the growth of our sport. It's also giving young athletes, especially youth, boys and girls, opportunities to play our sport in many countries. And, of course, the clean doping record that our sport has had ever since it's been participating in international events.
Don, take a breath there. I feel like I'm on the IOC committee here vetting your application. Let me just bring in Dave Zirin. Dave, who is on the IOC? Who gives them the power to decide what actually goes into the Summer Olympics?
Well, they give themselves the power. I mean, the membership of the IOC are people who come from the 205 National Olympic Committees themselves, and it's made up of a little bit over 100 people at any given time. And the problem with the IOC is that they're given this remarkable power, and yet the process by which they make decisions is something that is both shrouded in mystery but also just enmeshed in corruption. I mean, the amount of corruption scandals that the IOC has been involved in over the years I think would make a Illinois politician wince. And you have this remarkable synergy happening right now as we speak, where the city of Chicago is attempting to bid for the 2016 games. And I don't know, bringing Chicago and its political establishment together with the IOC, it's like who's going to give each other more fleas at the end of the day.
Now, it sounds like Don Porter, who's from the softball, he's the international president of the Softball Federation, he is trying to bend over backwards to get softball back into the Olympics. What are the sports going to have to do to make it?
I think Don is doing yeoman's work because it's very, very difficult to try to push the IOC in one direction or another. And softball is a sport, and Don, of course, can talk about this with more expertise than me. My understanding is that it was discontinued because it was thought that the U.S. was overly dominant. And in some degree, for the best thing that ever could have happened to softball was the fact that they lost the gold medal game in Beijing to Japan in what was considered probably one of the great upsets in Olympic history. It was the first time the U.S. had ever lost a match. And it was done after it was already announced that softball was going to be discontinued. And there's something, once again, there's something just very arbitrary, though, about how the IOC is able to make these decisions and what sports are or aren't allowed. I mean, we have rhythmic gymnastics. We have synchronized diving. We have synchronized swimming. Ping pong, of course, now is an Olympic sport. Oh, I'm sorry, table tennis. And how these decisions get made is something that I think leaves a lot of sports fans scratching their heads.
So, Dave, isn't the Olympics just not trying to make the sports and the games actually just more interesting to watch, get a younger audience? It's all about the audience, the sponsorship. Are they just not trying to keep it up to date?
Well, keeping it up to date, I mean, that's a very good question indeed. I mean, one of the problems is that the IOC, it presents itself as this nonprofit body, and yet all the TV contracts you hear about, all the sponsorships you hear about, I mean, it all gets funneled, and people can do the research on this themselves. There's some terrific books out there about it. There's a great one called Lords of the Rings by a gentleman named Andrew Jennings. It's a good resource for people. But they get 8% themselves, the IOC, as its own body, of all the money that gets generated through sponsorship, through television deals and whatnot. And the other 92% gets funneled through this very amorphous structure called the Olympic Movement. And that's all kinds of organizations in different countries, which are things that are supposed to be apostles of what are called like the Olympic ideals.
I'm going to leave the conversation there with you, Dave, talking about the Olympic ideals. Dave Zirin is a sports writer and author of the book A People's History of Sports in the United States. Don Porter is president of the International Softball Federation. Thank you to you both. We're going to have to wait to find out in August if softball will be included in the 2016 Olympic Games. No doubt we will be covering that news then. But now, with today's brand new headlines, Mark Garrison.
Again, loving your theme music. So I'll start with something high-minded. We'll
start
with the White
you.
House like that.
It's not
I
for you.
Like that. I can't complain
about
inspiration. But in any case, at the White House today, the focus will be on North Korea. President Obama meets with South Korean President Lee Myung-bak. The meeting comes as President Obama is expected to order the U.S. Navy to intercept North Korean ships suspected of carrying nuclear technology. That's according to senior administration officials in a report from our partner, the New York Times. The Navy will request permission to inspect ships, but will not board them by force. North Korea has said it would view forced inspection as an act of war. Yesterday, President Obama met with Italy's prime minister. Italy is now agreeing to accept 3 Guantanamo Bay detainees, a step in the president's ongoing effort to shut down the prison there. Finally, a Gitmo detainee accused of masterminding the 9/11 attacks said he lied to interrogators after being tortured. The statement comes in a newly released transcript of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's 2007 military hearing. John Femi.
Thanks, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. We begin this segment in Iran. Over the last 24 hours, no shortage of pictures of violence and crowds and demonstrations in the streets of Tehran with sounds like this. Demonstrators protesting yesterday in the streets of Tehran. Hundreds of thousands of people from across Iranian society poured out into the streets to protest what they charged were fraudulent results in last week's presidential vote. And those protests are continuing today. Iran has seen the largest demonstrations inside that country since the 79 Islamic Revolution. And today, Iran's Guardian Council say they are recounting the votes in Friday's deeply divisive election. That's according to state television. And the repercussions of all this are far and wide. There you're listening to the sound of Iranian Americans in Washington, D.C., singing in solidarity with fellow protesters on the streets of Tehran. For more on the international reaction to the elections, and there is reaction all over the world, I spoke with BBC diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus in London earlier this morning. In the diplomatic world, there are a lot of countries poised as to how to respond. And when I spoke with Jonathan, I asked him if he saw a pattern emerging here.
I think the pattern can be summed up in one word, caution. Everybody is watching very, very closely what is happening in not just in Tehran, but as far as they can get information elsewhere in Iran. But nobody wants to be seen to be intervening one way or another. I think President Barack Obama himself has very much set the tone. It's a concern about violence. It's a concern that the views of the Iranian people should be heard. But nobody wants to be seen, you know, to be backing one side or another. It's something that the British Foreign Secretary earlier today in an interview with the BBC made very clear, David Miliband. He said that nobody should fall into the trap of being seen to back one side or another. This isn't a pro-West versus anti-West competition in Iran. It's a competition, he said, to reflect the will of the Iranian people. And I think we have to hold fast to that point. And I think that sums up rather well, broadly speaking, the wide swathe of diplomatic reaction.
Indeed, gauging the will of the Iranian people is really the key there. Director of the Iranian Institute at the University of St. Andrews is Ali Ansari, who also joins us. Ali, good morning. And
good morning.
How would you gauge the will of the Iranian people as the outcome of this election seems very much in doubt this morning?
Well, I mean, the size of the crowds has been quite extraordinary, but also the range and breadth of the protests have also shown the sort of the level of the frustration, I think, in the Iranian population at large. And I think this election and the way it's been run, I mean, I think this is the anger at the process in which it's been managed, I think has just unleashed all sorts of underlying discontent, which has now come out. And of course, it's reflected also in a strong division in the leadership. So I think this is what's quite different about what's happening now, that not only do you have mass protest, but you have really quite serious divisions in the elite.
But you've also got some very curious contradictory phenomena going on. And Ali, I wonder if you could decode them for me. On the one hand, the Guardian Council says it's literally going to recount the votes in the deeply divisive elections, picking certain precincts. I don't think it's going to be a total recount. Yet, Ahmadinejad, the nominal winner of the election, is in Russia, suggesting that he has confidence that this is all going to turn out in his favor.
Well, of course, Ahmadinejad is still technically president, you see. I mean, the new president wouldn't be inaugurated till August, so he still has to function in that role, although one would suggest that perhaps he might want to pay more attention to what's going on domestically than going off abroad. But obviously, he's performing his duties as he sees it as president. I think the Guardian Council, I mean, we do have to bear this in mind, and I mean, most people in Iran will be aware of this, that the secretary of the Guardian Council, Ayatollah Janati, already has made his prejudice is clear. He said right before the election that he favours Ahmadinejad. So nobody has any doubts as to the objectivity of the Guardian Council. But I think quite clearly what they want to do is to try and calm the situation, put this into a sort of a legal process as they see it, and really get the crowds off the streets. That's what they want to try and do. And I think people will be aware that there's a certain sort of, there's a two-track game going on here, that, you know, their main task at the moment is to get people off the streets, restore order, and sort of channel the criticism through various bodies, which, of course, I think even the opposition politicians, I mean, and we say use opposition very loosely here because they're all establishment figures, will also be aware that the Guardian Council, perhaps, at the end of the day, while it's a route, is not the perfect route.
All right. Well, you know, even though the people may leave the streets, the echoes of protest are very much in evidence online in media coming out of Tehran and echoing around the world. Jonathan first, and then Ali before we go. What is the sense that even Western governments are paying attention to Twitter feeds and media feeds online that the Iranians haven't been able to suppress as a way of following what's going on inside the country.
Well, it's a very important source for all of us to try and follow what's going on inside the country. And I think it shows how, you know, all of these new media clearly change in some ways the political interactions when you have dramatic events like this. But I think the clear thing that people are waiting for is to see how this ends. You know, what impact is it going to have on the way Iran is governed? How will the balance within the country's ruling elite change, if at all? And of course, the crucial question for the outside world, what's it going to mean for the way Iran conducts its relations with the outside world?
Well, Ali, before we go then, what is the state of this social media in Iran right now? There was some folksy coverage of Facebook pages favoring Mousavi during the election. It's gotten a lot more serious, hasn't it?
Well, I think this is one that must be one of the first social protest movements, whatever, that's been really conducted very vigorously on the internet, and each side is almost trying to hack into the other side's websites. And I found it quite interesting to see that some of the government websites have also been down because the opposition have been working on that. I mean, it has been quite remarkable, and it's created a certain cohesion to this protest movement, not just in Iran, but also beyond its borders. So, I mean, I've been receiving email galore, really, from all sorts, and it's almost like a real-time account of what's going on, with all sorts of questions being asked, you know, how accurate is the information? You know, are they being fed misinformation, so on and so forth. So it's been quite interesting how they've tried to keep one step ahead of the authorities. And it does show, really, that, you know, this movement and those who are that work on the internet and others are not simply just part of some sort of North Tehran elite.
Well, there's a lot of credibility there. I mean, I wish I was reading Ali Ansari's email inbox rather than the New York Times this morning in some respects. That was Ali Ansari, director of the Iranian Institute at the University of St. Andrews, and also BBC's diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus talking to us early this morning about the international reaction to last week's widely disputed presidential elections held in Iran. Reaction you can see on the streets this morning. Mark Garrison now has our headlines.
Thank you, John. A busy morning for economic news. Two key reports just came out a few minutes ago. First, housing, where new construction is up more than 17%. That is the largest jump in some 3 months. Contractors generally don't build unless they think they can eventually sell, so there's apparently some optimism about the housing market out there. We've also got fresh numbers on inflation of the wholesale variety, that is. Producer prices rose by 0.2%. That is short of the rise analysts expected. Retail inflation, as in what you and I buy, is out tomorrow. General Motors has struck a deal to sell off another unit. Sweden-based Saab will go to a group led by a tiny Swedish car maker. The company is Koenigsegg, and it's little known except by car enthusiasts and extremely rich people. It makes only about a dozen a year. They cost a lot of kroner. Custom-built sports cars that start at more than $1 million apiece go up to 250 miles an hour. Watch for that sale to be done later this year if approved. The White House is turning down a request for aid from California. The Washington Post reports that top officials in the White House want California to get its budget in order without a federal bailout. California officials argue the state's economy is so large that the U.S. can't afford for it to fail. Femi and John.
Thanks, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Femi Okay. Four of the world's economic powers, Brazil, Russia, India and China, are sometimes referred to as the BRIC group. They will be meeting today to work out how to exert more control over the global financial system. On the agenda, creating a new currency that could replace the US dollar. Joining us is Clifford Levy, the New York Times Moscow Bureau Chief. Clifford, hello there.
Hi.
This is really all about the dollar. How likely is it that the group will agree on a strategy to actually reduce the dollar's importance?
Well, it's actually highly unlikely at this point. It's kind of very early in this process. Everyone pretty much agrees that the meeting, this summit of the BRIC nations, is largely symbolic. It's basically an effort by these four countries to express displeasure at the current structure of the economic system. They essentially believe that they have been among the primary engines of economic growth in the world in recent years, and as a result, they deserve more of a say in how the financial system is set up, and especially moving forward as the world's most powerful nations try to figure out a way to reorient the financial system in the wake of the crisis.
So we have Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Is one of those countries more powerful than the other in the BRIC group?
Well, certainly China has a far larger economy than the other three. I think it's actually larger than the other three economies combined. However, Russia and Brazil have been the most outspoken. They have chafed the most under the what they would refer might refer to as the tyranny of the dollar. China has been somewhat critical, especially in March and in April. The Chinese prime minister and the head of the Chinese central bank essentially attacked the United States fiscal stewardship, saying that the U.S. is taking on too much debt and expressing some worry that as a result that might lead to inflation, which would, of course, devalue the enormous Chinese holdings of United States treasuries. India has been a little bit more quiet on some of these issues.
So if the dollar isn't going to be the global currency, what are these four areas, these four nations actually suggesting should be the currency? Are they going to invent one? Would they like us to have a new one?
Well, what they're trying to do now is take, perhaps we might call it some baby steps. One of the things that they're doing is they're trying to diversify their financial reserves away from dollars a little bit into bonds or notes that are sold by the that are held by the International Monetary Fund. There's also been some talk about conducting trade among these four countries in their own currencies. And not conducting trade among the four in the dollar.
Well, they could do serial box tops too. They don't have a lot of flexibility here. Clifford, I'm wondering how much of the pain, the alleged pain of transacting in dollars, goes beyond simply the problem of the world's energy being transacted in dollar-denominated oil.
Well, there's oil, which is very important to Russia. Brazil has large numbers of agricultural exports. China exports, of course, enormous amounts of manufactured goods. All that is essentially conducted in dollars, which is why all these countries have accumulated these vast holdings of dollars. But, you know, a lot of this is much, you know, it's being conducted on two levels. It's the kind of nitty-gritty financial issues and then purely the symbolic issues.
Excellent. Clifford Levy, thank you. We're going to leave it there. Thank you so much. He's the New York Times Moscow Bureau Chief. That was Clifford Levy talking to us from Moscow.
Sorting out the difference between the real and the symbolic there.
Absolutely.
In that meeting is really fun.
And talking about the BRIC meeting, Brazil, Russia, India and China meeting in Russia today.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, it's Femi Okeh and John Hockenberry with you this morning. The rising cost of healthcare is one big hurdle to getting treated. We'll be learning about how some doctors are treating it through something called micro practices. More on that in a couple of minutes. But we've been asking you to design the perfect health plan for yourself. So how would you make it affordable? Steve sent us an email. He says, if the healthcare insurance companies provide reimbursement for herbs and Chinese medicine, the cost of regular pharmaceutical drugs will drop like my blood pressure after a good workout. Thanks for that, Steve. So how would you cut your costs? Tell us, 1-877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Time to catch up on the latest news headlines. Here's Mark Garrison.
Thank you, Femi. 12 minutes before the hour. Earlier today, Iran's powerful Guardian Council announced it's ready to recount disputed votes from last week's presidential election. Official results declared incumbent President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad the winner, but his main opponent says the vote was rigged. The dispute hasn't kept Ahmadinejad from travel. He's at a regional summit in Russia today. He did not mention the election in a speech he gave there. China was also in attendance at the summit. It announced it will loan $10 billion to the group's member states. Chinese leader Hu Jintao says it's intended to back up struggling economies in times of economic stress. And opening arguments begin today for the federal trial of former Louisiana Congressman William Jefferson. He's charged with soliciting bribes, racketeering, and money laundering. Femi.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Health industry groups are expected to deliver specific plans to the White House today.
If you like the plan you have, you can keep it.
To take over the healthcare system, either directly or indirectly, for the government to control it.
A lot of my friends, where they get their healthcare from is the emergency room. They're in the emergency room every week. They break a nail in the emergency room.
How are you going to avoid not having the ability to cost shift as you shrink that portion of privately funded health insurance?
Good morning, everyone. This week we're talking about the cost of health care in this country. Barack Obama, of course, and the Congress are putting it front and center on the legislative agenda. We will see how that turns out. But many people have already gone ahead and done their own innovation in health care, and we're going to talk about those in just a moment. But Barack Obama yesterday took it to the doctors. He spoke before the American Medical Association, and his biggest applause lines came when he mentioned this.
We can build a health care system that allows you to be physicians instead of administrators and accountants, a system that gives Americans the best care at the lowest cost, a system that eases up the pressure on businesses and unleashes the promise of our economy.
Many in the healthcare economy have suggested that the way the system operates, doctors spend much too much time being accountants and administrators. But many doctors have also taken into their own hands their quality of life and have modified the way they do their own practices so that they don't spend so much time pushing paper and spend more time taking care of patients. And we have two of those doctors with us this morning, Dr. John Wasson, a geriatrician and professor of community and family medicine at Dartmouth Medical School, joins us from Norwich, Vermont. Dr. Wasson, good morning.
Good morning.
And Dr. Moitri Savard, family physician who runs a micro practice, so-called, in Long Island City, New York. She joins us from Queens. Doctor?
Good morning.
Explain to me, first of all, what a micro practice is and how it represents an attempt by doctors and medical professionals to improve the quality of their health care delivery, even as they reduce costs.
Sure. Well, my practice is a smaller practice. I have about 700 active patients. I use a tremendous amount of technology, including electronic medical records and online scheduling. And my patients have tremendous access to me via email, cell phone. I have low overhead. I don't have a lot of staff. I share my rent with other people in the community. And I offer my patients longer appointments. In general, my appointments are 30 minutes long.
Now, do you bill them by the minute, the way lawyers do? How do you change your financial relationship with your patients to execute this style of treatment?
I actually do take insurance, and the difference is I don't have a lot of staff helping me with the insurance. So I'm actually down there trying to get reimbursed and working with the insurance companies on payments. So really, the financial relationship hasn't changed from the traditional relationship.
All right, let's go back to Barack Obama for a moment. Dr. Wasson, I want you to listen to this and tell me how it resonates with you. This is Barack Obama speaking yesterday in Chicago at the AMA.
That's not why you became doctors. That's not why you put in all those hours in the anatomy suite or the OR. That's not what brings you back to a patient's bedside to check in or makes you call a loved one of a patient to say it'll be fine. You didn't enter this profession to be bean counters and paper pushers. You entered this profession to be healers. And that's what our healthcare system should let you be.
Dr. John Wasson, what is it in the healthcare system that prevents you from being a healer, and how do you get back to that traditional healing that Barack Obama spoke about yesterday and that rhetorical flourish there before the AMA?
Well, there are probably two things that keep doctors from engaging in what they can do best. The first is the waste that Moitri just articulated. A typical doctor's office like hers spends about $70,000 a year in time and energy and in staffing dealing with administrative stuff. And that obviously takes time from somewhere else. And that is what Barack Obama is alluding to in the first part of his message.
Dr. Wasson, before you continue, what is it that is the incentive to spend that $70,000 if you're a physician? Why do that kind of work if it's so miserable?
Because you have no choice.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
Very simple.
Continue.
And the second part of the message, hidden to a great degree is that there's a huge amount of waste throughout the system in the way the doctor's offices are actually organized. And Moitra has nicely articulated a way that she has minimized those costs in her practice so that she doesn't have to run so fast, cut patient time so much to cover an excessively wasteful overhead.
Dr. Savard, does increased patient time on the front end of your treatment reduce the number of tests and procedures that might be assigned or prescribed for patients on the back end at hospitals and other facilities?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I have a lot more time for patient education. And so patients understand that really, for example, a full body CAT scan is not what they need, that the radiation involved is not worth, like, you know, the little piece of information they might gain from it. I spend a lot of time on that kind of counseling. Unfortunately, in our current reimbursement system, physicians are paid by, you know, very procedurally based. So a lot of the counseling we do isn't reimbursed, but it does save a tremendous amount of money and time on the patient's part.
Dr. Wasson, convince me that paying more upfront for a longer doctor visit is going to save me money in the long run, if that's the structure for me as a consumer. And then I want to talk about some of the incentives before we go.
Well, it's hard to convince that time alone is an important commodity, although lack of time certainly is. So all of us would agree 3 minutes with a physician is not going to cover the issues that matter to you. So you have to add to what Moitra is saying, which is the time she's able to spend with her patients, with the information quality and her ability to respond appropriately. And so in the practices that we work with around the country, we spend a lot of time focusing on methods to really make any time spent very valuable, using technologies, using office redesign.
All right, quickly, this is a kind of a yes-no, optimism-pessimism question for both of you. Are you confident that this wave of reform is going to put the incentives in the direction of these kinds of cost savings? Congress says it's going to cost us $1 trillion one way or another. Dr. Savard?
Yes, but I'm an eternal optimist.
All right, Dr. Wasson?
I'll say no, but I'd like to be an optimist.
Dr. John Wasson, thanks so much. Dr. Wasson is a geriatrician and a professor of community and family medicine at Dartmouth Medical School. And Dr. Moitra Savard is a family physician who runs a micro practice in Long Island City, New York. Thanks so much to both of you.
So you heard our doctor's take on healthcare and maybe how to actually perfect it. What would you do yourself? You've heard about micro practices. How would you make healthcare affordable?
This is Dr. Stephen Kahn, Princeton, New Jersey. A practicing general and vascular surgeon for 41 years. None of your suggestions works. The only one that will work is a national health system removing all profit margin.
So what's not covered in your health care? How would you cut the cost? Tell us your take at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
Let's not forget, foreclosures don't just affect the homeowner. They affect your neighbors. They affect property values for entire cities.
That is Anya Kamintz on the wide-ranging effects on foreclosures. She's a staff writer for Fast Company magazine and author of Generation Debt. Now, if you want to listen to that interview, maybe you missed it, take our podcast to go by subscribing at our website, thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm allowed to say the last line because my name basically rhymes. I'm Femi OK. And
rhymes
this...
with what?
You ruined it. One more time. I'm Femi OK. This is...
Oh.
The Takeaway.
Oh, you're
duh!
A poet. You're a poet.
Oh, absolutely.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Just in time for spring, a big, huge, stinky flower.
The flower's starting to open.
Everyone, flare your nostrils in olfactory anticipation.
Hey, it's a real crowd gathering in California to watch the famous corpse flower bloom. When evolution goes terribly wrong, hey, that's the wrong attitude, John. Amorphophallus titanium is our friend on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Tuesday, June 16th. That's right. Full coverage of the blossoming of the corpse flower out in California coming right up. I'm John Hockenberry. Across from me, co-host Femi OK.
Good morning, John. Good morning, all. Coming up this hour, we will hear reports on opposition demonstrations in the streets of Tehran. We also go over President Obama's speech to doctors yesterday on the state of the nation's health care. And in California, well, it stinks of rotting flesh. It blooms once every 11 years or so in 100 years. It's not my love life. It is the corpse flower. More on that coming up in just a bit. But after
thanks for sharing there, Femi. And in the headlines, we're just getting news in from the Associated Press that Iranian authorities are restricting all journalists working for foreign media from reporting firsthand from the streets. This would keep images of the protests over last week's disputed elections from being transmitted. In mass protests yesterday, hospital officials in Iran say 8 people were killed. Meanwhile, Iran's Guardian Council says it's willing to recount all contested ballots from last week's presidential election. Initial results returned President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad to power, but all 3 opposing candidates have challenged that, citing voter fraud. Femi?
Here in the United States, many lawmakers are taking a hands-off approach to the Iranian elections for the time being. Here's Republican Senator Richard Lugar. He chairs the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he was talking on CBS News today.
Our position is to allow the Iranians to work out their situation. When popular revolutions occur, they come really from the people. They are generated by people power within the country.
President Obama was also hesitant to take a position on the Iranian elections yesterday, but did say that Iranians have a right to know their ballots have been counted. On the economic front, there's some new economic numbers just out this last hour. New home construction was positive. The number of new homes that broke ground last month jumped more than 17% from April. That's the largest increase in 3 months. Meanwhile, the Labor Department says that wholesale prices rose by 0.2% last month, less than analysts expected. The global economy will be a topic of conversation between President Obama and South Korean President Lee Myung-bak. They will meet today at the White House. Security concerns over North Korea's recent nuclear tests will also be on the agenda. And President Obama is expected to order the U.S. Navy to intercept North Korean ships suspected of holding nuclear technology. That news comes according to senior administration officials who spoke with our partner, the New York Times.
Asian stock markets took a tumble today. It follows a bad day on Wall Street yesterday. The Dow tumbled more than 2%. The S&P dropped 2.4%. It begins trading at 9:24. Futures are on fire after those economic numbers that Femi mentioned. We're asking you to redesign the healthcare system. Continue your strong opinions at 877-8MYTAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Hundreds of thousands of people from across Iranian society poured into the streets yesterday to protest what they charge were fraudulent results from last week's presidential vote. Iran has seen the largest demonstrations there since the 1979 revolution. Today, Iran's Guardian Council says that it is recounting some of the votes in Friday's deeply divisive elections. And that news comes according to state television. We wanted to get some information and some news, some feedback from how Iranian Americans are processing the elections. So we're joined by Hadi Gayemi. He's the spokesperson for the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran. And he used to work for Human Rights Watch as well. Hadi, good morning to you. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning to you.
How are you managing to stay in contact with Tehran?
Basically, internet is the main form of communication we have, and also there, of course, the traditional means such as telephone, but internet chats, emails, Twitter, Facebook, all of these things are being very effectively used by the Iranian youth to communicate with the outside world right now.
Share with us some of the stories, the information that you've been collecting over the last 12 hours or so.
Yeah, for the last 12 hours, for one thing, I must say the situation is really fluid. People themselves are not sure what is happening. For example, yesterday's rally, which drew at least a million people to the streets of Tehran, no one was sure if it is going to happen or not. So the accounts I got was that people all around 4 p.m. started to approach the designated area. They weren't chanting. They weren't demonstrating. Everyone just started to see if there will be other people showing up too. And slowly as it got to 5 o'clock, they realized that there are huge crowds also coming in that direction. And eventually within an hour, we saw the pictures that how the rally got underway. There is much desire by the people who are going out there that it doesn't turn violent. They don't want to be engaged in any kind of confrontations, and it was really sad that the rally ended with some shootings and 8 people dead.
Well, we have 2 rallies today. One is for President Ahmadinejad, one is for the main opposition candidate, Mousavi. What information are you getting about those rallies that are happening in the next couple of hours or so?
Yeah. Well, the Mousavi campaign just came out a few hours ago warning that this is a death trap, meaning that there are pre-planned projects to make this a very violent confrontation. I'm not sure what effect it's going to have on his supporters coming out, but the images I've seen of central Tehran is that Ahmadinejad's supporters already have taken over the spot where people were going to go. And we're waiting to hear back that whether the pro-Mousavi people are gathering in an alternative location or are they going to challenge them.
Well, Hadi, here's a typical Twitter exactly on this subject. Just a few moments ago, you've got a Sky News reporter who went by an Ahmadinejad rally and says that a few miles away there are a few hundred Mousavi reporters and then decided to go towards that demonstration, and authorities took away his satellite access. So his latest Twitter is, I'm going to make a new blog within the hour, but right now I'm going to shop and stay away from the authorities.
Exactly. So you can see that real-time information is coming out very fast, but the authorities are nervous about that. You mentioned that foreign journalists have been told not to report firsthand. And our main concern is that they may really shut down internet completely.
You work for the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran. What are other concerns about people's human rights that have risen from these latest rallies and these protests?
Well, not only the level of violence used against them has been beyond measure, and now we have a number of deaths. We are seeing on the margins of this news of many activists and prominent people being detained, which is not getting proper attention. These are people who have been fighting under Ahmadinejad for highlighting human rights issues, and I think they're using this occasion to go after them and detain them, and we have no idea where they are, who is holding them, and what will happen to them. So we do worry about the extensive disappearances that are underway right now.
Hadi Gayemi, your spokesman for the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
It's very interesting. All you need to do is Google, and all sorts of sources of live coverage of Iran come up. And that was just one that was typical there, what Hadi was talking about there. President Obama, to shift gears here for a moment, spoke in a very, very important speech yesterday. He talked to doctors as the healthcare agenda gets going in Washington. His speech was in Chicago, and on Capitol Hill, we've got our first estimate of the health reform under debate right now. Last evening, the Congressional Budget Office passed judgment on one of the key bills overhauling the health insurance system. Well, as doctors sort of mull over Barack Obama's speech and the rest of us mull over the giant number that the Congressional Budget Office revealed yesterday, we've got Todd Zwillick, who's monitoring all of this for us. Todd, of course, is the Takeaway's Washington correspondent. So, Todd, when Barack Obama rolled out his health care plan. I seem to recall the number $634 billion over 10 years. Now the CBO has a number that approaches a trillion. Why'd the number go up, and what are they looking at?
Well, you have a good memory, John. $634 billion was the number that they had. The president always said that that was a down payment. He was very careful to say that. So 634 meant the number was going to go higher, and it has gone higher. The reason is because now that we have a bill, they can start to estimate exactly how many people will get covered, what it might cost, and the breadth of this plan. The 634 was never really attached to a number. It was just kind of the number they thought they could pay for and that they could pass in a budget. So now we're talking pretty close to an even trillion, according to CBO.
And this trillion would be over how much time, and what would we get for our trillion? Universal health care, for instance?
Yeah, not even. It's over a decade, but you don't even get everyone covered, according to CBO. CBO said in their report last night, and it's preliminary. Now, those bills are not in final form. When they are in final form, we're going to know a lot more about the cost and who's going to get covered. But so far, they say you get 39 million people will probably sign up for this kind of insurance exchange that the president wants to have as kind of a clearinghouse for insurance where individuals and businesses.
Let me stop you right there. So voluntary program, they estimate 39 million joiners. Okay, keep going.
Right. You get 39 million joiners, but about 20 million people who already have insurance through their employers or other government plans will drop away from those. So the net gain in insurance is probably only around 16 to 19 million. And don't forget, we have 47 million people with no coverage at all. So the net gain is still nowhere even close to universal coverage. And by the way, let me add, Republicans have not been happy about this process at all so far. Let's hear from John Kyle, the Republican whip in the Senate and also member of the Finance Committee. He's been one of the leading voices against the entire plan and how they're trying to put it together. Listen to Kyle.
Many people think that Canadians and Europeans get the same quality of health care that Americans get, but pay less. That's not true. The stories you hear from individuals in those countries about months and years-long waiting lists and denial of care are not cherry-picked scare stories. They are commonplace. People often have to wait months for an MRI or a dental procedure or a hip replacement that they urgently need.
John Kyle talking about the exchange, but also the public plan, which is this thing that we've been hearing about. We don't know what the public plan is going to look like. Let me just add one thing that Kyle's talking about. The England
besides
and
trashing the Canadians and the Europeans, right?
Right. And there's lots of things to trash about them. However, Canada and European systems have better outcomes than we do. They live longer and they have better infant mortality. So even though the systems can be frustrating for people in those countries, they are healthier than we are.
I have a question about what you said earlier. Now, supposedly 39 million people are going to join this new system in this bill, right? But
right.
That's going to push 20 million people off their current health care plans that they have. Where do they go, and why would they be pushed off?
Because one of the aspects of this is that they may be having policies, taxes, potentially higher taxes on health care benefits that cause either employers to stop offering coverage.
Aha.
or the insurance exchange is just a better deal for individuals and they choose to switch. It's not necessarily you're getting thrown off of it. They say, well, you know, what I can buy on the exchange is just cheaper and it's better coverage. I'm just going to move off of it. Or it has better tax incentives. So a lot of those things are yet to be determined, but they think that millions of people, either their employers will stop offering or they'll choose to move off.
All right. So the $1 trillion number is pretty scary. We've got a sense of the incentives that are going to cause some costs to rise, even though $1 trillion over 10 years is a chunk of change. It's not going to cover everybody. The debate is just getting started, right, Todd?
That's just getting started. We're going to find out about a public plan. We're going to find out about potentially higher taxes for some people who have these so-called Cadillac plans, maybe $14,000, $15,000 per year. All those things to be determined, but we're going to find out a lot more later this week.
Well, stay tuned. That was Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick on healthcare, beginning the debate in Washington.
So we've been asking you to design the perfect healthcare plan for yourself. How would you make it affordable? How would you cut the costs? 1-877-8-MY-TAKE. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
If it's not perfect, don't bother, though.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. This is John Hockenberry. They may be taking their good old time on Capitol Hill to debate health care, but we've got it started right here on The Takeaway. We've been asking you to design the perfect health care plan for yourself. How would you make it affordable? Patrick emails us. Why not just get rid of the middleman? Instead of adding a new government bureaucracy to the existing mix of public and private payment bureaucracies, encourage people to open tax-deductible medical savings accounts, which might be converted to retirement savings if left unused. Leftover from the George W. Bush administration.
That's right. I'm hardly ever sick. I'll be very rich by the time I get to your age.
Well, Femi, okay, then just call 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org with your idea.
I will email eventually. Bit busy right now. Good morning, everybody. The motto of the Los Angeles Police Department is to protect and serve, but the LAPD hasn't always delivered. The most famous example, of course, is Rodney King, the Los Angeles man beaten by four LA cops in 1991 in an attack widely believed to be racially motivated. Now, the Rodney King and other scandals led to federal oversight of the LAPD, but now the LAPD says that it has served its time, dealt with its problems, and it's time to end oversight. So is the LAPD ready to police again on its own? Not a question I'm going to answer, but a question that our two guests will do. Mark Rosenblum, he's the legal director of the ACLU of Southern California, one of the lawyers in federal court seeking to extend the consent decree involving the LAPD, and Chris Stone, criminal justice professor at Harvard University. And Chris wrote a nine-month study on the LAPD that came out last month. Good morning to you both, gentlemen. Let me start with Mark. Mark, can you just say, just set out for us just briefly, why the Justice Department decided oversight was necessary?
The consent decree was entered in 2001 after a decade of incidents of police misconduct. The 1991 Rodney King beating that you mentioned, there was also a scandal in 1999 known as the Rampart Scandal, where police officers were found stealing illegal drugs, framing gang members, and committing extortion. The department opened up an investigation of the LAPD and found a systematic pattern and practice of police misconduct, of civil rights violations, of improper use of force, of improper officer-involved shootings, improper stops and seizures and arrests, and based on that, filed a lawsuit, and that's what resulted in the consent decree.
Now, practically for the LAPD, what does it actually mean in terms of their day-to-day business?
The consent decree has resulted in significant reform with respect to the issues that we're talking about, or at least several of those issues. But 8 years later, the department remains out of compliance with at least seven categories of the provisions of the consent decree. Most importantly, what you started to talk about, and that was racially biased stops, racially biased use of force, racially biased policing. So the department still has serious ways to go. As it turns out in Los Angeles, if you're African-American, you're three times more likely to be stopped by the police than if you're white. You're 166 times more percent more likely to be ordered out of your car, to be frisked, to be asked for consensual searches, notwithstanding the fact that even after those stops and frisks take place, the likelihood, if you're black, of being found with criminal weapons or drugs or other evidence is significantly less than whites, 42% less than whites,
right,
for example, in the area of frisk.
Okay, Mark, let me leave you there for a moment. Let me bring in Chris Stone, criminal justice professor at Harvard University. Chris, you spent 9 months studying the LAPD. Mark has just reeled off a lot of statistics about the LAPD, particularly when it comes to racial bias. But what did you find?
We found the department had changed a lot, as Mark said, over the 8 years of the consent decree. We found basically the public confidence, trust and confidence in the LAPD is way up. About 83% of L.A. residents now rate the LAPD as doing a good or excellent job. And importantly, that includes about more than two-thirds, more than 70% of black residents and Hispanic residents. Right across the board, we found increased confidence, increased satisfaction with the LAPD's job. But we also found that they were doing a better job, that the law enforcement activities, the stops, the The arrests are of a high, there are more of them, but they're of a higher quality. We found morale was up. We found police community relations were strengthened. In general, we found the use of force was down, which is really important in this context. There are still lots of problems in the LAPD, as there are in almost every police organization in the United States. The question is whether the federal court oversight is still necessary. And in that sense, we also found that the other oversight in L.A., the oversight by L.A. institutions, which is crucial, was beginning to pick up and work well. And it's really to give those mechanisms a chance to really govern the LAPD and protect people's rights that we ended up concluding the LAPD was ready to have the federal court monitoring end.
Well, is this a political ploy by William Bratton, former New York cop, who's the commissioner of the LAPD, if he can get the feds off the neck of the police department, he would benefit, right?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, he certainly doesn't benefit personally. I think it is certainly something a police department wants. Think about Chrysler or GM. You know, if you weren't able to come out of bankruptcy, you'd never go in. And the system we have in this country is when the federal government intervenes, what they try to do is get a department to cooperate and enter a consent decree, go under federal oversight voluntarily. And police departments are never going to do that in this country if you can't get out of bankruptcy, if you can't come out of federal control. And the way you come out is you don't become perfect, you become able to govern yourself.
Actually, what I would say is that the way you come out of a consent decree is that you comply with the consent decree, and that hasn't taken place yet. The most recent monitor's report, the federal monitor that the that Judge Feist employs to look at the behavior of the department, still finds the department deficient, including especially in areas of racial biasing. And Professor Stone's report, which is quite expertly done, nonetheless found, for example, and I'm quoting from it, a troubling pattern in the use of force in that African Americans and to a lesser extent Hispanics are still subject to the use of force way out of proportion to their share of contacts with the LAPD.
Gentlemen, thank you for joining us this morning. We knew you had differing opinions, but we really appreciate the fact that you shared them with us. So Mark Rosenbaum, he's the legal director of the ACLU of Southern California. Chris Stone, Guggenheim Professor of Criminal Justice at Harvard University. Gentlemen, thank you. Time now for a look at the headlines with Mark Garrison.
Thank you, Femi. Coming up 29 minutes after the hour. New economic news is just out a few minutes ago. Industrial production did worse than expected last month. It's down 1.1%. It's a broad measure, the total output of all of America's factories, mines, and utilities. Analysts blame weak demand for big-ticket items like cars and household appliances. Overseas, Iran has barred foreign media reporters from the streets as more protests break out. Also today, Iran's top legislative body says it's ready to recount contested votes in last week's presidential election. Hospital officials say 8 people were killed during protests there after incumbent Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was declared the winner. Ahmadinejad isn't letting the contested results keep him from presidential travel. He's actually attending a regional summit in Russia today. Femi and John.
Thank you very much, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Hello there, I'm Femi OK here with John Hockenberry this morning. Try not to make you feel sick, but we have been asking you to design the perfect healthcare plan for yourself. So how would you make it affordable?
Hi, this is Jean calling from South Dartmouth. I think one good place to start for reform would be with maternity care, and I think that healthy, normal births should be not in hospitals, they should be at home. One example of costs, how this would help is I had my son at home and it cost me about $3,000 out of pocket. And had I done that in a hospital, I would have had to have a C-section and it would have been upwards of $20,000 is my estimate.
Tell us your budget at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. How would you save money with your health care?
Well, staying with California, and maybe it is the case that I am trying to make you sick, but think of this. If you're a species and you're 6 feet tall, you only bloom once in a decade, maybe. When you do, you smell like rotting flesh. You've got to ask yourself, what's the evolutionary advantage of a creature like that? And then when you realize that the so-called corpse flower, Amorphophallus titanium, actually needs humans to prevent its extinction, you really have to wonder if there's a design flaw here. Joining us now from Huntington Botanical Garden in San Marino, California, Jim Folsom, director of the gardens, is with us. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
You got to feel sorry for the corpse flower if it needs humans to keep it from going extinct and has all of those bizarre characteristics. But there's a lot of excitement about the blooming of the flower, right?
You know, there's always excitement surrounding this plant because it is so darn unusual.
And I've mentioned a couple of qualities. It stinks when it blooms. I mean, does it really smell that bad when it blooms?
Well, yeah, if you unless you're a fly and you think that a rotting horse is a delightful fragrance, then yes, it stinks when it blooms.
I see. Now, the rotting horse smell, would that be an evolutionary advantage because it attracts flies which somehow pollinate it or something like that?
Precisely. It is a smell that flies find alluring.
I see. And what about other corpse flowers? Do they find it alluring too? But I guess they don't mate like animals.
No, they have a different system.
Right. Now, I've heard that the shape of this flower, this plant, is unusual enough to have actually meant that women were not allowed to actually look at it in days of yore.
Well, there are stories about that. I don't think people were ever as prudish as we like to think they were.
But I don't want to describe it. But is the key to what I'm talking about in the Greek Amorphophallus titanium, the actual name of it?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
What's funny about the name is, of course, there are many different species, we call them, within this genus called Amorphophallus, and the ones that that caused the genus to be named didn't have such a prominent shape. This one, however, is quite prominent. It's a 6-foot column.
Wow. So what is the scientific significance of keeping this plant alive and of observing its pollination? And many people are going to if it actually blooms.
What is really curious is some of the most fascinating plants, least fascinating to me and to other botanists on the earth, are plants about which we know very little. And so here we have a plant that is notorious or so well known, and we don't know a whole lot about its biology, and that's true about many plants on the face of the planet. And so here we have this plant that's dramatic and wonderful and exotic, and yet we don't know a lot about what keeps it from going extinct. And here we are as humans changing the planet on a daily basis, and we don't even quite know how to stop from destroying all of the wonderful diversity around us.
Jim, hello there. This is Femi Okay talking to you. I love this plant. When I was a kid, I was obsessed with it. But how do you know at what point it's actually going to bloom?
You know, that's part of the mystery, is that this plant starts out, if you know a plant from New York area called Jack in the Pulpit, it's a near relative. And it comes up, instead of Jack in the Pulpit, it doesn't come up with a flower every year. It comes up with a single leaf, and it starts out as a small one from seedling. And then each year, each growing season, it puts out a new leaf that's bigger to the point that the leaf towers over you. So when it makes a leaf the size of a parasol in an outdoor cafe, a single leaf,
wow,
then next year, next growing season, you can think, this sucker might bloom. So you start paying more attention. And then finally, I mean, the next year it might come up with yet another bigger leaf, 9 feet tall, that has a span of 6 feet. So you're standing under this big parasol of a leaf. But then finally, you go out. We went out the other day, just only 3 or 4 weeks ago, and we saw this leaf perhaps emerging from the ground, and it just looked different because it had a big phallus right in the middle of it. And we thought, okay, It's going to bloom.
Big phallus right in the middle. Boom, it's going to bloom. Well,
it's going to bloom.
I'm thinking, what are these plants native of? Are they? I'm thinking, you know, Jurassic era, there's dinosaurs roaming around, these plants are everywhere.
I think that's only because it looks like it ought to be with a dinosaur. It's really a more recent plant. All of the aeroids, the arums, the philodendrons, this is related to, as I said, the jack in the pulpit. It's also related to that big mall plant, the white one, Spathiphyllum. So it's related to a lot of plants we know, but they're not that ancient of a group. So it looks ancient because it's got this bloodthirsty look about it,
right,
and it's giant. But perhaps it's not that ancient.
Well, Jim Folsom, last question. Millions of years from now, when biologists from another planet actually are examining what happened here on Earth, what will they be more curious about? This plant, Amorphophallus titanium, or the strange human beings that were attracted to it?
I think they'll be curious about where it all went. Why did it all disappear?
Like the storyline of the WALL-E movie, that's for sure. Jim, congratulations. I hope you get a bloom there, and we'll come out and visit when it happens. Live broadcasting from the corpse flower. That's a great idea.
I think that should be my assignment.
Jim Folsom,
you're
on your way to see Jim Folsom, who is the director of the Huntington Botanical Gardens there in San Marino, California, where a corpse flower is set to bloom for the first time, they hope. Mark Garrison has the other headlines.
Thank you, John. A lot of fresh economic news just out this morning. In the newest housing report, new construction is up more than 17%. That's the largest jump in some 3 months. Contractors generally don't build unless they think they can sell. So apparently someone has some optimism about the housing market out there. We've also got fresh numbers on wholesale inflation. Producer prices rose by 0.2%. That's short of the rise analysts expected. Retail inflation, that's the prices of regular stuff that you and I might buy, is out tomorrow. Some call General Motors' troubles a saga, so it's fitting the latest chapter has a Scandinavian flavor. GM now has a deal to sell off its Swedish arm, Saab, which would go to a group led by a tiny Swedish supercar maker. GM says the sale includes a $600 million commitment from the European Investment Bank, which is guaranteed by the Swedish government. President Obama is expected to order the U.S. Navy to intercept North Korean ships suspected of carrying nuclear technology. That's according to senior administration officials in a report from our partner, the New York Times. The Navy will request permission to inspect ships, but won't board them by force.
How's that going to work? Hi, do you have any nukes on board? Oh, you don't? Okay, all right, see you later.
It's called hailing. That's what sailors refer to as hailing.
Hi, looking for nukes? None? Oh, okay. That's a great program.
We will see.
The New York Times reported that?
We will see. They're partners.
Put it on
South Korean's page. South Korean's president meets with our president today as well.
Lots of stuff.
Thanks, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Femi OK. Have a listen to this. See if you can work out.
The California mystique with the surfing, they had it all. And I decided, maybe we could try that here. Bought a surfboard, and it was like all hell broke loose.
Well, he's a surfer.
Surfer from Buffalo, New York. One of the thousand or so who ride the barrels and head the high waves of the Great Lakes. Midwest surfers are cheering this week because of a change to a city ordinance in Chicago. And that means that people can take their boards into the Windy City's many beaches. So joining me now to talk about this news and just what the Great Lakes surfing is all about is Vince Dewar. He's the co-chair of the Great Lakes chapters of the Surf Reader Foundation.
Surf Rider Foundation.
Good morning there, Vince.
Good morning.
So for those of us who've never thought of taking a surfboard to Chicago, what's it like surfing the Great Lakes?
Well, it's a little bit unpredictable. You know, you have to be dedicated. It takes time, commitment, and, you know, it's not like surfing in Hawaii where the temperatures are warm all year round and we can enjoy the warm water. It does take some commitment.
Because it's freezing cold.
Often.
And the waves are smaller.
Yes.
And Vince, you're in Grand Rapids, Michigan right now, where I went to high school?
Yes, you are. Yes, I am.
Vince, there is no place to surf in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I know that for a fact.
Yeah, actually, I'm working in Grand Rapids right now, but I'm from Grand Haven. If you're from Grand Rapids, you know about that town. And we get waves. We get waves every month of the year. I mean, until the ice locks it up and the breaks away again. We surf every month of the year. We surf anywhere from 5 to 6 times a month, maybe more. just depends on the particular month. June is a pretty flat month, however.
So there may be some technical challenges for getting out and surfing in Chicago, but there were some legal ones as well. What happened before now?
Well, basically, years ago, there was an incident with a flotation device, basically just rafts, swim rafts, and where there were some swimmers that got in trouble. Since that time, the city took kind of a really strong stance on banning all flotation devices, including surfboards.
So there's a documentary that you made. It's called Unsorted, A Great Lakes Experience. I'm just going to play you a little bit of a clip from here. This is David Van Der Veen talking about the surfing experience.
You know, most people told us we were crazy. They were saying, what are you doing? You can't surf on the lake. You know, there's obviously waves out there. We're obviously surfing. In fact, most of the time we'd be coming back dripping wet, and some guy would say, hey, you can't surf on Lake Michigan.
So now technically you can, legally you can. What difference is this going to make to surfers?
Well, this makes the difference for my good friends who live in the city limits of Chicago. It means, you know, saving an hour drive, maybe a half hour out of town and a half hour back in. It means saving money on tolls. And it gives them some pride to surf in their city without looking over their shoulder, wondering if they're going to be ticketed and fined $500.
Where else can you surf in the Midwest?
You can surf on every lake. As you heard from my good friend and elder statesman, Don Henderson, he surfed in Buffalo, New York since the late 50s. People have been surfing Lake Michigan since the late 50s, early 60s. But every lake has surfers on it. Like Ontario, Toronto has a small surf scene. There are like surf groups along every lake, but we're just a smaller group. You'd say that we were dwarfed by the hunting and fishing groups.
Wonderful.
To be sure.
Vince Duer, thank you for joining us this morning, co-chair of the Great Lakes chapter of the Surf Rider Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hello there, Femi OK and John Huckenberry taking care of you this morning. The president is looking for ways to cut the costs of healthcare. How would you make healthcare affordable? We're looking for your ideas.
Hello, my name is Jeff. We should have some kind of per illness deductibles that are fairly high, and therefore we would not have insurance cover mundane illnesses, your typical problems, but would take care of severe and chronic illness.
You got a more cost-effective idea than Jeff for healthcare? 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Time for some news headlines with Mark Garrison.
Thank you, Femi. 12 minutes before the hour, Iran's powerful Guardian Council says it's willing to recount contested counts from last week's presidential election. Official results named President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad winner, but the leading challenger calls the vote a fraud. Ahmadinejad is not letting the controversy keep him from travel. He's in Russia today attending a regional meeting. He did delay that from Monday, though. At the same summit in Russia, Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh met with Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari. That would be their first meeting since the Mumbai terrorist attacks in November. A detainee at the Guantanamo Bay prison camp says he lied to investigators while being tortured. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed made those statements in his 2007 military hearing. The transcript is just out yesterday as part of an ACLU request. John and Femi.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Have you noticed in Washington, it seems as though the czars are back, the
right.
Romanovs. Yes, we've got the health reform czars, mm-hmm. pay czars, car czars.
I see the Russian hats.
It's like a trip through the steppe on a sleigh.
The Cossacks dancing.
In a Russian opera. So the question is, are there more czars in the Obama administration, or is it something that the media has simply coined? And what is really the Obama role in doing something that presidents have done for generations? That is, try to get around the constitutional requirement that serious positions in the executive department be confirmed by the Senate. Shirley Ann Warshaw joins us, presidential scholar at Gettysburg College, author of The Co-Presidency of Bush and Cheney. She joins us from Harrisburg. Shirley Ann Warshaw, thanks for being with us.
Oh, hi.
great to see you. Great to talk to you.
We actually talked with Ken Feinberg, who's supposedly the pay czar for bankers who get TARP money, and he took very serious exception to being called a czar.
Good for him.
And good for him. And I think this it's fair to say that this is a kind of a media designation.
Right,
But with these independent characters who report directly to the president, how much of a precedent is there for presidents doing this sort of thing? And do we think Obama is doing it more than it's been done in the past?
Sure. Yeah, no, good question. Let me just say, first of all, this word czar is a creation of the media in the last few years. It's very new. We never heard that before. It sounds good, particularly car czar. That has a lot of pizzazz to it. There really are. Let me separate this for a minute for you. There are two kinds of people running things. One are in the departments and one are in the White House. And they're somewhat different. And the one that everybody's talking about is the car czar, Steve Rattner. And he is actually an employee of the Treasury Department.
Interesting.
His title is Counselor to the Secretary of the Treasury. So he's an employee of Treasury. The compensations are that. So you're just talking about Ken Czar. His official title is Compensation Czar. And as you know, he oversaw the distribution of the congressional funds to the families of the victims of 9/11.
Ken Feinberg, right.
Right, Ken Feinberg. And he is also an employee of the Department of Treasury.
Huh.
So it is the Treasury Department hiring these. And all Feinberg is doing is working with the compensation for companies that receive federal funds, particularly the TARP funds, Troubled Asset Relief Program.
Well, let's step back in history then. I think a lot of people who are students of presidential history know the great battle that was fought between Henry Kissinger and the Secretary of State in the Nixon administration.
Right.
The National Security Advisor reported to the White House.
Right.
The Secretary of State, of course, is part of the Department of State.
Correct.
How does this work in our era?
Well, part of that is that the White House, and that's a good point, the White House in recent years, particularly since the Nixon administration, is trying to gain greater and greater control over a very complex federal government. We have 15 federal departments now. We have 3.5 million federal employees. And of those 3.5 million, the president only has 7,000 political employees within the federal government. So that's not really very many. It's a fraction of a percentage. 99.99% are civil service employees. So the president needs to gain some control over his own programs. There are very, very few positions in the departments, but the White House actually is almost all political appointees.
Right.
So what happens is that presidents, particularly since Nixon, you're absolutely right about the Kissinger case, have tried to put more and more power in the White House. And when you talk about the health czar, President Obama has actually put into the White House an office of health reform. I notice it's not health care reform. I think that's interesting. It's just the Office of Health Reform. And it's interesting because HHS, Health and Human Services, would be the natural home for health and human services for health reform. And yet that's a huge, huge department. They have Medicaid, they have Medicare, they have Social Security, they have public health, huge. So because it is one very important issue to this president, he has put a small staff headed by Nancy DePaul, who is actually a Rhodes Scholar and Harvard Law School graduate. She's a very smart lady who worked in the Clinton administration at OMB overseeing health care.
Well,
so
then
she knows the area.
Well, let's say, all right, I'm the CEO of a big hospital somewhere, all right,
mm-hmm.
and I've got a lot of Medicare business and Medicaid business that I do, right?
Right.
And then let's say that I'm some medical entrepreneur who really has a sort of a policy idea for health care reform.
Right.
If I come to Washington and want to have a power lunch, if I'm the hospital CEO, I probably want to talk to Sebelius, the Secretary of
exactly.
HHS, right?
Right.
But if I'm the policy wonk, I want to talk to the czar, right, Ms. DePaul.
Well, don't call her the czar. I don't
all
like
right,
that
I'm
word.
Sorry.
She is an expert. She is working in the White House. She has a very small staff. What is actually going to happen is actually going to be run through HHS. That's why Sebelius is the one that really still has the power.
I see.
But Nancy DePaul is really going to have influence in the policy process.
Well, it's an enormous headache to try to resolve as just a regular old taxpayer. Let's shift to the envoys, can we, for a moment? If you're Secretary of State Hillary Clinton,
mm-hmm.
now is Richard Holbrooke, who's the envoy for South Asia, and George
right. and
Mitchell—
remember, he is a State Department employee.
Right. And, I mean, are these people friends or foes if you're a Secretary of State Hillary Clinton?
Oh, that's a great question. Could be both. and Hillary Clinton— case, she's a very, very smart lady, and she has made them friends. She has brought these people into her inner circle. Remember, however, that Susan Rice, who is the UN ambassador,
right,
is not a Hillary Clinton person. She is a Barack Obama person. Clear, no question about it. In fact, Susan Rice was given cabinet status, which means she has equal status. She can talk directly to the president without going to the Secretary of State. That's pretty interesting.
Now, we saw this during the George W. Bush administration, but is it the case with the Obama administration that loyalty is the coin of the realm and some of these add-on positions are valued for their loyalty, where the bureaucracy positions are maybe valued for their management?
Well, there's a little bit of both. I mean, every president needs political employees to move forward his agenda. So much of what government does today is discretionary. Laws are written very broadly. If you want to move forward a program, you have a lot of discretion within the law as how it moves forward. So you want people that are loyal to you that understand how to move your programs forward within the law. And so much is done through discretionary authority and through executive orders today. There's one office, for instance. Let me mention the Office of Urban Affairs in the White House.
Okay.
This is a new creation of the Obama administration. It's being run by what I would consider, and this goes to your point, a political loyalist.
Right.
And this is you, Bronx Borough President Adolfo Carrion. And I'm not sure how well he will do there. It'll be interesting to see.
Well,
he's up against HUD. HUD is a pretty well-established group. They know how to deal with urban problems, Department of Housing and Urban Affairs. What can he do that they can't do?
Well, he is from the Bronx. The Bronx is tough, but we will see. It's certainly grist for a lot of historical lore, but I'd hate to make an organizational chart of the Obama administration right now. Shirley Ann Warshaw, thanks so much for setting all that in context
for
us.
My great pleasure. Thanks very much.
Shirley Ann Warshaw is a presidential scholar at Gettysburg College and author of The Co-Presidency of Bush and Cheney, and she does not like the word czar.
So we have been talking about healthcare this morning as well. President Obama's agenda is healthcare, amongst other things, and it's also on your agenda as well. You've been sharing your stories of why affordable healthcare is needed. Elise emails us, "I only discovered how limited my health coverage was when I became pregnant. The health insurance provided to me as a contractor was so limited that I used up all of my coverage on my first doctor's visit. Had I not been able to buy coverage through a union I'm a member of, I would have had to have paid up to $10,000 in bills for an otherwise uncomplicated pregnancy." So we want to know what you would do to make healthcare affordable. And your story is part of the conversation on our website. Take a look at it, thetakeaway.org. There's also a lot of extras there for you as well. You can look at pictures of the smelly corpse flower. It's worth it. A 6-foot column.
Ooh.
Best entertainment of the morning, thetakeaway.org. And John, of course.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Femi OK. This is The Takeaway. Have a great day.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.